Once again, you have your own eyewitness experience in Buckhorn to draw on here, Chief. In your own words, that portal seemed to lead somewhere. It also implies this. Since it's clear that Hastings and Davenport hacked this information on the Major's behalf from what they told us was one of our governmental agencies, it suggests that we already had this information in our possession, and Briggs knew it was there. Does this imply the same thing to you that it does to me? That, I'm speculating, Major Briggs knew about all of this because near the end of his own life, Doug Milford gave it to him? That Milford or Briggs, or both of them, figured out that Listening Post Alpha had gathered such beyond classified information, which, I've come to understand, is more or less our stated mission. More than possible. But is it also possible that the Major didn't initially realize what they had? Did something in the conversation Briggs conducted with the double at his house that day tip the Major off to this information's existence, or at the least to a relevance he hadn't previously realized it held? My question to you is, was it us? Did the Blue Rose Task Force possess this information? Was it actually our servers that Hastings and Davenport hacked into? A high school principal and a librarian? I mean, for crying out loud, who were these people, Russian sleeper agents? That was a joke, Chief, but the idea that these amateurs penetrated our servers is not. Not willing to give them that much credit, I'll offer another scenario. Briggs knew about the Blue Rose Task Force, so is it possible that near the end, when he realized the double was coming for him, he stashed the information inside some innocuous digital cutout where he knew no one else would look for it? We've since learned from Twin Peaks law enforcement that the Major hid a similar clue to the local set of coordinates for his son Bobby in plain sight, concealed in his favorite armchair. I believe this argues for the second option as the more likely. Briggs stashed the information in a place that would not have posed insurmountable entry barriers to amateurs like those two Buckhorn rubes, in a place where no professional would even think to look for it. Misdirection. I'm rooting for this interpretation, by the way, for obvious reasons. Now let's ask ourselves what the double was up to in all of this from his opening move. We know that Agent Cooper disappeared somewhere in the Ghostwood Forest that night more than 25 years ago in pursuit of Wynda Merle. We know that he reappeared the next morning along with Annie Blackburn and was found by Sheriff Truman. We can also say with a high degree of certainty that this particular he was the double. This was its first confirmed appearance, which means that the real Cooper was most likely still inside wherever he disappeared into the night before. There are indications in many of the accounts I've examined, on and between the lines, that Cooper had found his way into some kind of out-of-time place or portal similar to the zone described by Major Briggs. For instance, the ancient pictographs on the walls of Owl Cave are alleged to depict how access to such a place is attained. Deputy Hawk is on the record citing a local Native American legend to describe this particular place. His people call it the Black Lodge. I'm going to suggest, for the sake of convenience, that we call it this too. Or if that term doesn't work for you, I suggest we refer to it as something like the Hotel California, in that you can check in, but you can never leave. At least not for 25 years. Once the double disappeared from Twin Peaks after his meeting with Briggs, he utterly vanished. Every maximum alert all-points bulletin issued around the world by the Bureau failed to turn up any trace of him for the next quarter century, save two. There was a surveillance photo of the double from a South American sting operation, which certainly appears to be him, though analysis did reveal hints of digital manipulation, so in the Photoshop era, it may be impossible to authenticate. The second, Cooper appears more clearly on another surveillance photo from the bizarre glass box operation murder scene that you and Albert investigated more recently in Manhattan. Connecting these distant dots yielded the following conclusion, which, thanks to a boatload of forensic digging and dedicated effort across a multitude of disciplines during the past year, I have now been able to substantiate. Based on these findings, during his 25 years on the loose, the double appears to have established and run an international criminal syndicate to rival any cartel or crime family in recent memory. This organization appears to have inserted its tendrils into nearly every known vehicle for vice in the lexicon. Gambling, drugs, cybercrime, human trafficking, prostitution, murder for hire, illegal banking, stock manipulation, extortion, blackmail, insurance fraud. About the only criminal arena missing from the list is politics, aside from a few obvious bribes made to elected foreign officials, but chances are that'll turn up eventually. All the proceeds from this baroque, elaborate spiderweb, minus expenses and payoffs, of course, funneled directly to the top, to him, through a dense and complicated network of shell companies, LLCs, offshore banking, and the complicit, well-compensated participation of a number of known corrupt regimes and broken states. The entirety of the operation will take many years to unravel, but our early and likely overly conservative estimates suggest that the net payoff to the man at the top was in the billions. Although the double appeared to somehow travel freely throughout the world, establishing residences and businesses in a dozen different places, among them Las Vegas, Berlin, Amsterdam, Buenos Aires, the island of Cyprus, and Istanbul, he doesn't appear to have amassed all of these resources for the usual, more or less banal criminal outlets or indulgences we're accustomed to seeing: greed, lust, materialism, self-interested power, etc. Instead, he appears to have been employing this growing fortune for what I would suggest we call research. The double was after something, hunting something, and maybe more than just one thing. Here's what we know. He desperately wanted those coordinates from Briggs. He pursued him across a quarter century, even after an official public finding that the major had died in that car crash, and he never relented. If Briggs ever came out of hiding, from whatever manner of space he was hiding in, prior to appearing in Buckhorn, we have no record of it. But it's clear that the second time the major emerged to meet Hastings in Davenport, the double was there waiting for him. He killed Briggs, Davenport, Hastings, and anyone else who got in the way, seized those coordinates, and headed for their location, more or less directly, by way of the South Dakota prison and our former confidential FBI Blue Rose informant, Ray Monroe. Absent any information from Monroe, also subsequently murdered by the double, it seems clear that the double went to all the trouble of breaking into prison and breaking out with Monroe because the latter had some kind of information the double wanted. I'll circle back to this shortly. The glass box operation in New York, which we now know the double set up through a series of cutouts, suggests he was after something else as well. Some kind of entity that moved, as Briggs appeared to be able to do, free of constraints of time and space as we used to think we understood them. Something monstrous and murderous that appeared in that box and slaughtered those two kids who had the horrible misfortune of being there when it appeared. From the evidence we've seen, the only familiar word that comes to mind to properly describe this entity is demonic. And the glass box appears to have been installed there as a trap to catch it. Let's examine its motives from the first instance. The double seems to have wanted these coordinates to gain entrance to whatever space they led to find the place where Briggs had been hiding, a location or dimension where time appeared to stand still. This sounds crazy, even as I'm writing it, but we've both seen things during the course of this investigation, Chief, that are even crazier than this, so I'll just run with it. Was this portal the only one of its kind? Or was it just one of many entrances, like a subway stop into some sort of mysterious network or web that could be accessed from many different places? That seems likely. My thought is this. What if the double was looking for the most important location in this alleged system? A grand central station, if you will, on the other side. Final question, and it's one that all others lead to. What did the double want if it ever actually made it to this place? What was it after? Some kind of form or even greater power than it already appeared to possess? What would that be, immortality? I mean, I don't think it was trying to get there just to lodge a complaint or plead a case with whoever was in charge, do you? I want to take a step back for a moment. Let's consider the very existence of the double. You'll recall the mythological location I mentioned earlier, the Black Lodge, a hellish place of origin for people, entities, or creatures walking the dark path, posthumously referenced by Margaret Coulson in her funeral remarks. Deputy Chief Hawk also once spoke of another spiritual concept that may be related, called the Dweller on the Threshold. Agent Cooper mentioned hearing about it from Hawk in one of his tapes to Diane. This dweller is said to represent the sum total of all the dark, negative, unresolved qualities that reside in every human being. There are also esoteric theories that the same idea can apply to the fate of nations, but let's confine this to the more personal concept for now. The Dweller legend states that when a person on the spiritual path consciously approaches a place or state of soulful enlightenment, at the very moment when they're about to enter its full embrace, on the threshold, as it were, this dweller allegedly appears and must be confronted and defeated in order for the person to successfully pass through. As with most mythology, my presumption had been that this figure is allegorical, a metaphor for a struggle that takes place in the realm of the interpersonal and psychological, not a literal concept. But now I have to ask, is this literally what Cooper's double was? Albert and I have spoken of this thing before as a tulpa. A tulpa, like the false Diane, is a concept that in the original Tibetan, it turns out does not mean double or doppelganger, but rather an entity created or summoned by a dark magician or sorcerer through the practice of ancient and corrupt forms of esoteric magic, necromancy, demons, devil worship. Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, who wrote extensively about these matters in the 19th century, setting aside for a moment the many arguments about whether or not she was an outright charlatan, referred to this sect as the Brothers of the Shadow. I bring this up to make the point that the dweller scenario, in the doubles case at least, seems more likely to me than the tulpa. If we continue along these lines, is there a third alternative theory worth considering? Simpler, perhaps, but no less fantastic? This is directly related to another controversial concept you told me about from the original Laurel Palmer case. While in custody, shortly before his death, Leland Palmer claimed to be possessed by a demonic entity called Bob, and he attributed his actions to its lifelong malign influence over him. I've gone all over the evidence and contemporary accounts. They are bone-chilling to the point where, had Leland survived, one wonders if an exorcism might have been more efficacious than a criminal trial. Which leads me to pose this possibility. Was the double somehow similarly possessed? I realize we can't settle this debate with absolute certainty, or even a fraction of it, but I also think it's worth asking whether all these concepts fit together, logic and method be damned, and point towards something that's so far out of our perception that we'll never begin to grasp it if we don't tremendously enlarge our frame of reference. We saw what happened at the sheriff's station. There were close to 20 witnesses, including you, me, and Albert. We agree that we saw more or less the same thing. At the moment of its death, something appeared to rise up out of the double and disappear. Something not Cooper. And we know that no sooner had Cooper appeared to defeat this, whatever it was, that he almost immediately appeared at the location of the coordinates that his damn double was after from the start, and you went with him, Chief. And from there, Cooper promptly disappeared again and hasn't been seen since. And Cooper's former assistant, the real Diane, who had just appeared out of nowhere in a downstairs holding cell not long before all this happened, disappeared right along with him. Do I need to revisit the false, or tulpa, Diane that we all saw die in a Buckhorn motel room a few days earlier when she pulled a gun on the three of us? I mean, honestly, are they cranking out these duplicate creatures in an alternate reality Kinko's with some kind of Lovecraftian 3D printer? Pardon my French for a second, Chief, but what the fuck? You've described to me what happened when you left with Cooper. The lights went out of the sheriff's station. I was there for that part. You somehow found yourself in the basement of the Great Northern Hotel with Cooper. Something then opened up in a boiler room in the basement of the Great Northern, which you described as an endless corridor. You exchanged parting words. Cooper entered into it. This corridor, shortly after, closed. Cooper was gone. You were back in what appeared to be, as far as you could determine by any other measure, an ordinary boiler room. Okay. There's one last outlier in this fractured fairy tale that I feel the need to bring up now. References to him pop up far more than coincidence can account for around the margins of this whole narrative. I'm speaking, centrally, of a man I never knew, a celebrated Bureau veteran, your former classmate and colleague, the man you called the guiding inspiration of the Blue Rose Task Force. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP-15 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Philip Jeffries, confidential. In Cooper's files, he mentions a strange scene that supposedly took place in our Philadelphia offices in 1989. I have not found any corroboration of this in other Bureau records, by the way. Did you have them erased? Philip Jeffries had been on an extended and highly classified Blue Rose assignment that involved a long-term posting in Buenos Aires, Argentina. At some point during that assignment, while working undercover, Jeffries disappeared, every bit as abruptly as Cooper disappeared from Twin Peaks 25 years ago, without a trace. The difference being, on February 16th, after spending 6 months completely off the Bureau's radar, Philip Jeffries showed up, without warning, in our offices in Philadelphia. He was wearing a white linen suit, more appropriate for a tropical clime. It was the middle of a particularly nasty winter in Philadelphia, but summer in Argentina. Cooper described Jeffries as distraught and disoriented. When he asked and was told what date and year it was, Jeffrey seemed generally horrified and reacted with outright panic. He also seemed confused and troubled by Cooper's being there and seemed to believe he wasn't who he appeared to be. Cooper indicated in his notes that this conversation took place in your office, Chief, and that you and Albert were also present. Moments later, right in the middle of the conversation, apparently the three of you looked over and realized that Jeffries was gone, vanished. And as near as I can tell, the man was never seen or heard from again. Not in Philadelphia, nor Buenos Aires, where Jeffries had, by the way, been seen by multiple witnesses in the lobby of his hotel that same morning at roughly the same time while wearing the same damn tropical outfit, or anywhere else on God's green earth. Two questions, Chief. How did Philip Jeffries manage to be, or so it seems, in two places thousands of miles and a continent apart on the same day at the same time? Why was he so distraught upon learning what year it was? Why would he ask a question like that in the first place? Let's break this down. I've read every word I could find about Jeffries. He was, according to every account, a brilliant man, the only son of an old aristocratic Virginia family and a phenomenally talented law enforcement officer. One comment about him in all the profiles stood out for me. This world wasn't enough for him. You yourself wrote that. You knew the man better than anyone else, and you and he founded the Blue Rose Task Force together. You've confirmed to me that Jeffries was deeply and openly interested in a variety of esoteric and occult subjects, including things that one could have ripped from the ripest pages of pulp science fiction. I know the Blue Rose Task Force is charged with the investigation of matters that would make most average citizens, or the world's most expert neurophysicists for that matter, flee from the room with their hair spontaneously combusting. I know now that during its decades of operation, long before I came on the scene, you and Jeffries encountered phenomena that both of you struggled to understand or describe. What I went looking for was the moment when Philip Jeffries stopped investigating these things and started living them. The conclusion I would submit is this. It happened in Buenos Aires. I've tracked down the few scraps of information he left behind there, and one item in particular stands out. Although he went to Argentina in 1986 to investigate what appeared to be an international criminal enterprise, he very quickly focused in on an aspect of the case that I believe we've misunderstood all these years. Within his first month, Jeffries identified a shadowy suspect, someone he believed could be the central person of interest in charge of this entire operation. All he had, at first, was a name he mentioned that same day in your office. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP-16 of 18. Case agent, Tamara Preston. Judy, confidential. I know this because Cooper is also on record on one of his tapes to Diane from this period about the only part of this conversation that took place in your office that he could exactly recall. Apparently, the first words out of Jeffrey's mouth were these. I'm not going to talk about Judy. In fact, we're not going to talk about Judy at all. We're going to keep her out of it. Can you also confirm this for me, Chief? Someone named Judy. At least that's who Cooper and everyone else in the task force assumed he was talking about. Until I discovered something recently carved into the wall of his former Buenos Aires hotel room, near the phone, beneath a layer of new wallpaper that was added in 1997. It appeared to be the same name, but the spelling was different. J-O-U-D-Y. Carved, not written, deeply and hurriedly, with what appears to have been a pocket knife, next to the phone, as if he'd heard something on a call and had to carve it right there on the wall. Not with a pen or a pencil, but a knife. Why would someone do that? Because this information upset him? Because it affected him to such a degree that only a weapon could express the depth and intensity of whatever he was feeling at the time? Judy. So who was this person, and why would just a name have that kind of impact on Philip Jeffries? We know that previously he'd thought the name of the shadowy figure he was pursuing was Judy. Now he apparently had new information, an extra vowel, a slightly altered pronunciation, but what else did this change? What more did this tell him? I've done some research of my own. Judy, it turns out, is also the name of an ancient entity in Sumerian mythology. This dates back to at least 3000 BC. The name was used to describe a species of wandering demon, also generically known as an Utuku, that had escaped from the underworld and roamed freely throughout the earth, where they feasted on human flesh and allegedly ripped the souls from their victims, which provided even more meaningful nourishment. They particularly thrived while feeding, and I quote, on human suffering. These beings were said to appear in both male and female forms. Judy indicated the female, and the male was known as Baal. And while they were considered beyond dangerous individually, if a male and female ever united while on the earth, the ancient texts claim their resulting marriage would create something far more perilous, as in the end of the world as we know it. A few centuries later, Baal becomes better known in both Christian and Islamic sources as Beelzebub, a false god, or as he's known more generally and generically today, the devil. Do I have your attention yet, Chief? So what do we do with this information? How does it change the focus of what we're looking at here, if at all? What concrete leads was Jeffries onto? Are these just the insane ramblings of a man who, as you well know, swam in a sea filled with extravagant and esoteric conspiracy theories, a sure sign that he'd lost not only his way but his mind? Or do we calmly sit with this information and see whether and how it fits into what we already know? In other words, do our jobs. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP-17 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Ray Monroe, confidential. There's one more additional piece here that's crucial to consider before we proceed. Ray Monroe, the deep cover informant who apparently was recruited by someone involved with our task force to work on the missing Cooper case, succeeded in making contact with the double. Strong evidence suggests that Monroe penetrated his inner circle, met with him, and worked with him in the weeks or months prior to the double surfacing in Buckhorn, South Dakota. I've come across a vague reference that indicates that Monroe, 2 years before Buckhorn, began working this operation in Las Vegas, where we know the double had established part of his empire with Duncan Todd as his local principal operative. I believe that this is where Monroe's first contact with the target may have taken place. In a partially garbled phone message to an agency cutout, Monroe claimed that he was reporting directly to someone inside the Blue Rose Task Force, but he never specified who it was. If it was you, Chief, I believe you would have told us, wouldn't you? After the double succeeded in breaking into and out of the South Dakota prison, taking Monroe with him, we know that at some point before he died, Monroe made a phone call on a burner found at the location in Montana where we also found Monroe's body. Based on data retrieved from that phone, it seems that Ray Monroe believed that he had originally been recruited by and had all along been working for Philip Jeffries. Let me repeat that. Ray Monroe believed he had been recruited by and was working for Philip Jeffries, a man the Bureau had not seen or heard from since he disappeared from your Philadelphia office in 1989. I'll take this a step further. I believe it's not only possible, but likely that the double went to all that trouble to spring Ray Monroe because he had reason to believe that Monroe would tell him where he could find Philip Jeffries. I also think it's highly probable that after the double killed Monroe in Montana, he went looking for Jeffries. Let's pause here long enough to ask ourselves, why did the double want to find Jeffries? What did he hope to learn from him? This is where my own scientifically trained mind starts to encounter some pretty hefty cognitive dissonance, but here goes. By any measure, Jeffries' behavior in your office in 1989 was damned peculiar. He was shocked to learn what year it was. He said what he said about Judy. He also supposedly pointed an accusatory finger at Cooper and, panicked and afraid, shouted something like, "Who do you think this is there?" and then disappeared, although, once again, the appropriate esoteric term for something like this is disapparent, apparent being the Latin root for apparition, not just right in front of our eyes, but also on security tape. Shortly after 10:15 a.m., almost exactly when Jeffries reappeared, according to eyewitnesses, back in his Buenos Aires hotel before not long afterwards vanishing altogether. Since this doesn't make sense inside the lines of any rational logic I can support, let me suggest something batshit crazy. What if Jeffries, not unlike Major Briggs a few years later, had gained access to the same system of portals, holes in dimensional space that allowed him to disappear and reappear in places far apart in geographical terms, more or less at will? I'll take it one step further, Chief. What if these same portals also allowed him to come untethered from time? Wouldn't that help explain why Briggs hadn't aged a day in 25 years? Could it also explain how Ray Monroe believed that he was receiving instructions from Philip Jeffries? As long as we're skating on the thin side of the ice here, what if this not only made it possible to go forward in time, but also backwards? Could that explain the shock and dismay Jeffries exhibited in your office when he learned what year it was? After Monroe died, our investigators found a matchbook in his pocket for a roadside motel called the Dutchman's Lodge in rural western Montana. I personally visited the address on the matchbook, and there's nothing there. It's an empty space on the side of an old two-lane state highway. I then went back and checked historical records for the area and learned that there was such a motel at that exact location dating back to the early 1930s. It was built, owned, and operated by a man named Horace the Dutchman Vandersent. And it was known not only as a gateway to a sportsman's paradise, but as a mob and gangster-friendly establishment. Rumor has it John Dillinger once spent a week there while on the lam. The lodge was shut down not long after Vandersent died in 1962 and was demolished in 1967. For what it's worth, and it could, of course, have been a skillful contemporary reproduction, the matchbook in Monroe's pocket appeared to be relatively new. There's currently a 2-day gap in our knowledge of the double's movements between when he killed Monroe and when he showed up in Twin Peaks. Is it possible that after killing Monroe, the double went to this Dutchman's Lodge looking for Philip Jeffries? For what it's worth, the lodge's former location lay directly between Missoula and Twin Peaks. What might the double have learned there? Was it Jeffries who told him something about the coordinates he'd been given that then sent him on to Twin Peaks? Let me explain why I think this is possible. If Jeffries is still out in the ether somewhere, in the same way that Briggs was, lost or hiding in some kind of neither here nor there netherworld, could this experience be so assaultive and disorienting to the senses that one consequence is you're never completely sure exactly where or when you are? If we view Jeffries' behavior in your office in 1989 through this lens, his alarm at learning when he's there becomes perhaps more understandable. For argument's sake, let's assume that after he killed Monroe and learned about the Dutchmans, the double and Jeffries had some sort of contact outside of linear time at this no longer existing rustic Montana lodge. Now let's refocus on Jeffries' alarm at seeing Cooper in 1989. Who do you think this is there? Through this same bizarre lens, and this question comes up for me. Did Jeffries think he was seeing not Special Agent Dale Cooper, but the double? At this point, I feel I need to uncategorically state the following. Don't hold me to any of this, Chief. I am just putting it out there. TP, September 6, 2017. Federal Bureau of Investigation. Case number 008-072-0119. Bureau file number TP18 of 18. Case agent Tamara Preston. Today, confidential. Here's where it all moves beyond weird, Chief. No sooner has the smoke cleared after that shootout in Sheriff Truman's office with the double fading away and something black and spectral floating out of its body and up through the ceiling, don't even get me going right now on that oddball Cockney kid with the green glove, then the lights go out and you and Cooper apparently apparate to the basement of the Great Northern Hotel. After a brief exchange, Cooper vanishes in the dark down a long corridor that isn't actually there. The lights come back on, and you're left standing with the Horn brothers in a boiler room. And for the second time in the past 25 years, Special Agent Dale Cooper disappears from sight, sound, and the world as we think we know it. By the time you get back to the sheriff's station, Diane Evans, Cooper's longtime former assistant, whose mind-altering disappearance and doppelganger journey calls for, wouldn't you agree, an exhaustive investigation of its own at some point, who was seen by more than 20 witnesses emerging from a holding cell in the basement only minutes before everything hit the fan in Truman's office, has also now, without anyone in that crowded room noticing, including yours truly, once again disappeared without a trace. So when you jetted off back to Philadelphia later that day and left me to cover the aftermath of what went down in Twin Peaks, my first visit, charming place as you've always told me, but to be honest, Chief, I'm a big city girl and always will be. And to mop up, to quote Albert, this gargantuan, multidimensional clusterfuck, I decided to nose around a bit. This happened today, Chief, just a few hours ago, up to the minute. Earlier this morning, while perusing past editions of the Twin Peaks Post, outstanding small-town paper conveniently preserved on microfiche, for more than the fun of it, I went back to look up the occasion of the first Cooper disappearance from Twin Peaks. Sure enough, the intrepid Post reporting staff, expertly trained by their late editor Douglas Milford, featured his sudden and unexplained departure on their front page, along with pained and puzzled quotes from Cooper's pal, Sheriff Harry Truman, about how strange and confusing the whole business was. You know what else I discovered, Chief, in that same article a few sentences later? This. Agent Cooper had come to town a few months earlier to aid in the investigation into the disappearance, still unsolved, of local teenage beauty queen Laura Palmer. Let me repeat that phrase for you. Still unsolved. No mention of murder, wrapped in plastic, or father arrested for shocking crime eventually dies in police custody of self-inflicted wounds. It's right there on the front page. Laura Palmer did not die. So, fairly certain I've not misplaced my own mind, I go back and check the corresponding police records. They tell me this. Laura Palmer disappeared from Twin Peaks without a trace, on the very same night when, in the world we thought we knew, it used to be said she died. But the police never found the girl, or, if she had been killed elsewhere, her body, or made a single arrest. In every subsequent mention in an edition of the Post, the case is still listed as an open and pending investigation. And when I spoke to our good friends at the sheriff's office about this, they all got a slightly dazed and confused expression on their faces when I brought it up, as if they were lost in a fog, having trouble recalling, unable to fully wrap their minds around something that happened so very long ago. Until finally they said, each and every one of them, "Yeah, that sounds right. That's how I remember it." I started to examine the public records on the rest of the Palmer family. Their daughter's disappearance dominated the local news for weeks. The same set of suspects was identified and questioned. Jacques Renault, Leo Johnson, Bobby Briggs, James Hurley, as those who were known to have been among the last to see her. No useful information came from them and no arrests were initially made. The next day, Ronette Pulaski, the girl who had been abducted and nearly killed along with Laura, and who had apparently still been taken captive, escaped and ended up in the hospital after being found wandering along a railroad trestle just like before. But she also testified that Laura had wandered off into the woods before she and Leo and Jacques entered the railroad car. Laura was never there. After a while, with a complete lack of tips, leads, or sightings to move an investigation forward, the Laura Palmer story began to fade. Within a month, it had gone cold, another missing person story with no clear resolution. As mentioned, I did find a few stories in the Post about Agent Cooper coming to town to investigate Laura's disappearance. There are not many details to speak of, and he didn't stay long, and nothing much beyond that. As soon as I return to the office, I intend to look into whether any of Cooper's files or tapes that are still in our possession support this alternate version of events. I kept moving forward, searching for more information about the Palmer family. The following year, on February 24, 1990, the one-year anniversary of her disappearance, Leland Palmer committed suicide. Alone, with a licensed handgun in his car parked near the waterfall by the big hotel. The usual outpouring of shock, grief, and we-never-saw-this-coming stories appeared in the local press. The act was generally attributed to a father's overwhelming grief about the unresolved disappearance of his only child. Checking police records, I found that there were at least three visits paid to the Palmer house during that intervening year, all by Sheriff Harry Truman, but no further details about the reasons for them are available, and neither is Sheriff Truman. I decided to look at the history of the mother. With her being Laura's only living relative now, there was scarcely anywhere else to look. Sarah Judith Novak Palmer. I searched all the way back to her childhood in New Mexico, where the family moved months after her birth in Bellevue, Washington, in the summer of 1943. Her father was a Defense Department employee who had been transferred there to work in some small but unspecified subcontractor role in the Manhattan Project. The family lived outside Los Alamos in a new suburb built on the edge of the desert specifically for workers involved in the program. Nothing about their family life during that time particularly stands out, unless you count the first successful nuclear bomb test, codenamed Trinity, which took place at White Sands, New Mexico on July 16, 1945. You know the rest of that story. Less than a month later, atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the war with Japan was over. The Novaks decided to stay on in the area, her father still working for the Defense Department, and as far as the public record is concerned, the rest of Sarah's childhood passed uneventfully. But 11 years later, on August 6, 1956, there was a curious incident that I found reported in the local newspaper. That night, about 15 miles outside of the town where the Novaks lived, an AM radio station was viciously and mysteriously attacked. Two employees, a receptionist and a nighttime DJ, were found dead inside the building, their heads crushed in a particularly gruesome fashion by what forensics called extreme blunt force trauma. Included in the accounts that followed over the next few days, half a dozen sightings of strange, solitary figures in the area that night, on the road, with at least two placing them in the vicinity of the radio station. Details are sketchy. It was a dark, moonless night. But they sound like drifters, or as one witness called them, hobos. Also reported that night, shortly after the time they believe this attack took place, the station abruptly went off the air. At which point, more than a few people reported hearing strange electrical or mechanical word sounds coming over their radios for about the next 6 minutes. During this period, many local residents reported severe disturbances among their pets or livestock. A number of others, although only a few are named in the reporting, claimed that members of their family blacked out when they heard these transmissions. When the sounds stopped, just as abruptly as they'd started and the station went to dead air, which, when they were unable to raise anyone there on the phone, prompted police to head to the station, all of these people immediately regained consciousness with no memory of the event. Two of the people named in that account lived in the Novaks' neighborhood. Sarah Novak was one of them. According to her parents, they found Sarah unconscious and unresponsive in her upstairs bedroom. She came around in the back seat as they were rushing her to the hospital. According to the newspaper report, emergency room doctors found nothing wrong with the girl. It was the same with all of those they looked at that night. The paper suggests it was close to a dozen people, and she was released after a cursory examination. What to make of it? I have no idea, do you? This may not mean anything either, but all of this took place a few hours from the airbase at Roswell, where, as we know from the dossier, a young Army officer named Doug Milford allegedly witnessed the mysterious UFO crash 9 years earlier. Sarah's life rolled on uneventfully. She attended college back in Washington State, where she met the man who would become her husband, and later gave birth to their only child, Laura. After Laura's disappearance, Sarah experienced bouts of severe depression and was treated for it, as previously reported. In the years since, at least in the version where her husband commits suicide, according to medical records, she's battled alcoholism, addiction to prescription drugs, and social isolation. Oh, and in the past year, right around the time Cooper disappeared again and time took a vacation, she was named and questioned as an eyewitness to a particularly gruesome and mysterious death in a disreputable Twin Peaks dive where a man on the barstool next to her dropped dead with most of his neck missing. Chief, I'm glad I've written all this down rapidly because my own thoughts about every one of these events are growing fuzzier and more indistinct the longer I stay here, creeping into my mind like a mist. I can feel a kind of mental lassitude physically advancing on me. Something's wrong. Whether it's with me or this place, I don't know, and I don't really care anymore. I need to pull the emergency brake right now and get the hell out of here. I've booked a flight back to Philadelphia tomorrow. TP, September 6, 2017. Final thoughts. I'm on the plane now, in the air, east of Spokane. The uncanny penumbra I reported hasn't left me. I barely slept, but it's fading as I travel farther east. I don't know what to make of it. You wanted to know what happened there in that town and region to these people you knew, whom I feel I've come to know now as well. They meant something to you for a reason, I think, beyond just your knowing them, beyond that they were good or interesting people in their own right, because it was all there, in that one town. All of life, cradle to grave, every shade and color of the spectrum, like a fractal itself made up of infinite parts, the ocean in a drop of water. I feel like I laid my hand on a third rail that should be of concern to all of us, that a core fundamental of human existence is wonder, and its analog is fear. You can't have one without the other, flip sides of the coin. And even as we wonder at what we're doing here, so do we also fear. So deep down below the surface of our lives that few can bear to look at it. That life is a meaningless jest, an extravagant exercise in morbidity, a tale of sorrow and suffering lit by flashes, and made bearable only by moments of companionship and unsustainable joy. Along the way, as we struggle to come to terms and comprehend why this strange fate has befallen us, time becomes no longer our ally, the spendthrift assumption of our youth, but our executioner. It all feels at times like a merciless joke made at our expense, without our consent. Is the evil in us real? Is it an intrinsic part of us, a force outside of us, or nothing more than a reflection of the void? How do we hold both fear and wonder in the mind at once? Does staring into this darkness offer up an answer or resolution? What does it give us to hold on to? Does it reveal anything at all? Or can the simple, impossible act of persisting to look at what's in front of us finally pierce the blackness and reward us with a glimpse of something eternal beyond? Is that heaven? How do we manage it? The only answer I can console myself with is this. What if the truth lies just beyond the limits of our fear, and the only way to reach it is to never look away? What if that's why we must keep going? Why we can never quit trying to overcome it in every moment we're alive? Look at what's happened here. One town. The commonplace, familiar, and ordinary. Everything we think we know until you sense the deep, unsettling strangeness informing all of it. How easy it is to quit, give up, lower our eyes. Look at what happens to anyone here who lost the fight, many of whose stories we both now know so well. How recklessly, stupidly we toss away this one chance we have, simply squander it, money down the drain, 1,000 different ways. We're holding the coin of the realm in our hands the whole time and we can't even see it. What I've learned from this place and about these people terrifies me. I'll frankly admit that. How much of what I know, what I've been culturally attuned to believe, feels like the set of a play on a strange stage I've wandered onto without knowing why I'm here. I don't know the lines. I don't know what part I'm playing. I don't even know what this play's about or what it's called. I'm just here, on stage, stuck in a dream, lights shining in my eyes. Is anyone out there watching? The play stumbles ahead, feels like artifice, mistakes, frippery, an endless series of false starts, bad assumptions, all the while shadowed with a constant horror that something unforeseen could drop down on me from above or lurch in from the wings at any moment, that the floor could open up beneath me and instantly erase even this small, pitiful existence, put out the lights for good. Chief, this has changed me. You predicted that, and I should have known you'd be right. But you can't know what you don't know until you do. It's because you've already been through it, I think. Does this feeling end? Can you tell me you come out of the other side to some kind of understanding, or do I have to take that as another article of faith? There's only one redeeming feeling I can cling to, provided I ever get that far, and I'm not saying I'm there yet by any stretch. But when it's all stripped away and you realize you're the only one who can put the pieces of yourself together, by yourself, alone? No easy answers from book, song, or movie, or the reassuring words of someone older and wiser? I'm noticing it has a tendency to focus and sharpen the mind, and strengthen the will to live constantly with all my senses wide open to the here and now. One clear idea emerges from that crucible, forged and hard as rolling steel. We mustn't give up. Ever. T.P. September 6, 2017. This is Annie Wershing. We hope you've enjoyed Twin Peaks, a Macmillan audiobook from Flatiron Books. This program was engineered by Michael Cox, post-production by Danny Meltzer, Laura Wilson, producer. Text copyright 2017 by Mark Frost. Production copyright 2017 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.